honestly concerned and very scared of this, you know, this person being on the Supreme Court.
Alaskans travel to D.C. to ask Senator Murkowski to vote no on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 23rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the State Gas Line Corporation says the China LNG deal can continue, no matter who is elected governor.
We were created as an organization that would be somewhat apolitical. The project would move forward based on its merits and economic viability.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska and a group supporting Mike Dunleavy for governor filed a lawsuit today challenging state limits on signs along highways, including campaign signs. The lawsuit comes after the State Department of Transportation recently removed some political signs. Alaska has had a prohibition on advertising along state highways in some form since 1949. That's prior to statehood. There are a few exceptions, including for scenic attractions. The law bars signs within 660 feet of a highway, including interstates and other state-designated roads. The prohibition includes both public and private property.
Here we go, guys.
Tally-ho.
All right, heads up.
Senator Lisa Murkowski met today with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Most meetings in her D.C. office don't merit press coverage, but Murkowski is one of a few Republicans who may vote against confirming Kavanaugh. As Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports, opponents are watching her closely, hoping she'll vote no to help sink his nomination.
Some 30 Alaskans flew to the nation's capital this week to urge Murkowski to vote no. Among them was Leanne Gonzalez, a student at UAA.
I made a very personal appeal, and I asked her to vote no on his nomination because I was, I'm honestly concerned and very scared of this, you know, this person being on the Supreme Court.
Gonzalez was born with a heart condition that required surgery. She says Kavanaugh is hostile to a key promise of the Affordable Care Act, that people with pre-existing conditions won't be denied insurance coverage. Whether Kavanaugh really is opposed to the Affordable Care Act is a matter of dispute. But Gonzalez says Murkowski seemed receptive to her message.
I brought a picture of my, a baby picture, post-surgery with this giant scar on my, you know, tiny baby chest, and she was really moved by that, and I felt very optimistic.
Gonzalez says her way was paid by Protect Our Care, a healthcare advocacy group. Anchorage retiree Joni Bruner made the trip, too. She was a last-minute addition to her contingent, and Bruner was not exactly sure who bought her ticket. She thinks it was a group called Center for Popular Democracy. Bruner says the new justice should be a middle-of-the-road centrist.
If we were to confirm an extreme right person, it would further divide our country, and we really want to stay together.
Kavanaugh has been making the rounds of Senate offices for weeks, and a photo op is a routine prelude to each meeting. Murkowski's real meeting with Kavanaugh was behind closed doors. Nothing of substance was discussed in their minute in front of the cameras. But Murkowski did take the opportunity to introduce Kavanaugh to Walter. That's a giant salmon trophy on Murkowski's wall.
So that's Walter 63 down to Kenai River. We're trying to work on.
Murkowski's office later issued a statement saying their discussion included health care, privacy, Indian law, and laws specific to Alaska. The statement provided no insight into which way she's leaning. Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing is scheduled for after Labor Day. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Okay, can you guys duck so I can get a shot of the fish?
No. the state's liquefied natural gas pipeline export project with China can continue regardless of whether Governor Bill Walker is elected to a second term in November. Walker, an independent seeking re-election, has made the mega project a top priority, while Republican challenger Mike Dunleavy has expressed skepticism about the state's ability to manage it. Alaska Gasline Development Corporation Senior Vice President Frank Richards says the AGDC was set up by the legislature to transcend election cycles.
We were created as an organization that would be somewhat apolitical. The goal was that the project would move forward based on its merits and economic viability.
Richards was in Fairbanks yesterday to update the community on the project, which faces a self-imposed year-end target date to sign a binding agreement with three Chinese government-owned companies, under which they would finance three-quarters of the $44 billion project in exchange for three-quarters of gas line output.
So I would say that we are actively engaged with that. It's a negotiation with a very astute buyer of LNG. So we are doing our due diligence to make sure that we are getting the best contract for Alaska and our resources.
Richards says the agreement will guarantee the Chinese buyers a discounted natural gas price over the 20-year life of the financing.
That's where we have to make sure that we're going to acquire debt financing that is not too expensive. And then we'll be able to utilize our equity portion to be able to sell to the remainder of the Asian markets to acquire higher returns for the 25% remaining.
Richards emphasizes that the Chinese companies will not own the gas line, but notes that the AGDC is required to offer up equity shares of the project.
We're going to develop an equity offering that we'll take out to the world markets, including Alaskans, individual Alaskans, Alaskan municipalities, and Alaska Native corporations the opportunity to invest in this project.
Richards says the offering is expected to be issued this fall. On another front, Richards says the AGDC is negotiating with North Slope producers ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil to supply the gas line. It already has a contract with BP. Officials in Anchorage are reevaluating the city's strategy for reducing homelessness. At a press conference at City Hall today, the mayor's administration unveiled a new two-part plan they hope will improve coordination and accountability. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
In a packed conference room, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz announced the formation of something called the Homelessness Community Leadership Council.
It's a group of community leaders who are going to make sure that we hew to the right course when it comes time to following through with our homelessness plan and making sure that resources are properly allocated, making sure that funding streams go to the right place, make sure that we break down the sort of silos that have made it hard for us to have the kind of results that we should have had in the past.
Co-chaired by the mayor and one of the heads of Providence Hospital, the council has 10 additional volunteer members drawn from prominent nonprofits, private companies, and real estate groups. The idea is to facilitate conversations between people who aren't typically coordinating when it comes to the issue of homelessness, and Berkowitz says to use the funding more efficiently.
Part of the problem is when I talk about the $25 million plus that's being spent on homelessness in this community, it's very diffuse, it's not organized.
The second part of the measure is an update of the comprehensive strategy for reducing homelessness. The plan, called Anchored Home, is still in draft form, and the administration has public events next month to gather input from community members. Jasmine Kahn directs the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness and is overseeing the initiative. She says the aim is not just to have strategies put on paper, but offer clear deliverables among stakeholders, establish accountability, and collect good data on different groups dealing with homelessness.
Really, what Anchored Home is about is coalescing these plans into one plan so that we're looking at the problem holistically versus looking at each population.
The document will be finalized and implemented in October. The municipality is holding a public hearing on September 18th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the world's largest container shipping company is preparing to send a test vehicle through the Arctic for the first time.
Their major strategic competitor is active in the Arctic, so I think they're feeling some pressure to explore it as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Coast Guard Air Station Kodiak just received the first of five newer, more technologically advanced aircraft. The HC-130J replaces the HC-130H that the Coast Guard has been operating since the 1980s. Each Model J costs a total of $85 million. The fixed-wing aircraft assists in dropping survival equipment and enforcing maritime law, among other duties. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche was there to see the plane's arrival.
The new Model J taxis down to Hangar 1 through streams of water from two fire engines on either side of the runway. A crowd of Coast Guardsmen has gathered to watch the welcoming ceremony. Among them is Air Station Commanding Officer Captain Brian Daly. He says pilots will transition between flying the older model and the J.
The pilots can fly one, can't fly the other. It's totally different when you walk inside. And Alaska is a very unforgiving environment. And so teaching the guys to fly up here, is a challenge. And so for this next year, we're focusing on getting our pilot and air crew cadre proficient in the aircraft.
The new Model J looks pretty similar to its predecessor, the Model H, but it's apparently a lot quieter, at least according to someone who's used to the noise. Lieutenant Commander Hunter Atherton is stationed in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and was one of the pilots to fly the J into Kodiak.
Some people really like the roar of the H model, and this one doesn't quite have that, but it is a lot more efficient overall.
Do you like the roar?
I kind of do, actually. But they're both good. I'll definitely miss flying H's now that I'm flying J's.
He says the J comes with a few improvements, including a more powerful engine, more automation, and a better navigation system. He says the plane's extra features could help cut through challenges pilots face landing in Alaska.
Having access to a plane that's going to have GPS-based approaches in the near future, which the J model will have, hopefully in the next couple of years, that's huge. That'll be huge for Kodiak to be able to have access to airplanes with that capability.
Atherton says there are 13 J models, and Kodiak is the only other station where the J is being used. According to the Coast Guard, Kodiak's four other aircraft should arrive by fall 2019, and the program aims to have 22 of the new aircraft nationwide. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The world's largest container shipping company is about to send its first cargo vessel across the Arctic. It's a small step, but a significant one in the expansion of trade in Arctic waters as ice recedes due to climate change. The shipping company, Maersk, says that the trip is a trial voyage. They've characterized it as an exploratory one-off, which will enable them to assess the feasibility of the route. Ryan Yulia is a senior fellow at the Arctic Institute in Washington, D.C. He says that the move is notable due to Maersk's high profile, but it doesn't signal an imminent wave of container shipping in the Arctic.
I kind of think we're more talking about a scale of decades rather than years before that is a regular occurrence.
Yulia says that the success of container shipping companies like Maersk depends on their reliability, getting goods to ports on time. And in the Arctic, weather and ice conditions are still too unpredictable for shipping companies to consider regular routes there. But despite those difficulties, the Chinese state-owned shipping company COSCO, a competitor to Maersk, has been sending ships through the Arctic for several years. Yulia says that's one factor driving Maersk.
Their major strategic competitor is active in the Arctic, so I think they're feeling some pressure to explore it as well.
Maersk's vessel is traveling the Northern Sea Route, starting in a Russian port near the border with China and moving up through the Bering Strait, along the Russian Arctic coast and into Europe. New routes for the Bering Strait were approved earlier this year by the international organization that sets standards for marine safety. The Maersk ship is expected to enter the Bering Strait around September 1st. Quinnahoc took a big step to redraft its cultural narrative this month with the opening of the largest museum collection of Yupik artifacts in the world, on the coast of the Bering Sea. KYUK's Christine Trudeau reports that the village has been regaining pre-contact cultural knowledge, leading to a deeper understanding of its Yupik heritage.
Elder Grace Hill speaks to a crowd of over 150 people packed shoulder to shoulder in the Quinnahoc Village Corporation building on a cloudy Saturday afternoon. It's August 11th, and the community has gathered to celebrate the official opening of the Nunahlak Culture and Archaeology Center. The collection of over 60,000 artifacts and counting is owned and controlled entirely by the Native Village Corporation of Quinnahock. Elders have known about the old site at Nunahlik for some time. People were encouraged not to disturb the area, but artifacts began emerging as the permafrost thawed and the site eroded. The University of Aberdeen in Scotland was called in to help. The window to save the items is small, because most artifacts decompose quickly once unfrozen. What they found confirmed old stories handed down by elders of what they called the Bow and Arrow Wars, which took place hundreds of years ago. Elder Grace Hill says she's glad the Village Corporation acted fast to save the artifacts while keeping them under local control. Hill encourages other tribal communities to do as they have done, adding that it's crucial artifacts stay within tribal communities, as many items in the past have been taken to places like the Smithsonian Museum for other people to learn from, outside the Yupik cultural context. Keeping objects in Quinnahock in the long run isn't cheap. Archaeologist Stephen Street works with the Association of Village Council Presidents.
Most of those collections were organics, and so they need specialized skills to keep those maintained in proper environment and all of that.
The corporation is meeting with museum professionals and others in an effort to support the project long term. Quinnahock Village Corporation President Warren Jones says the community, elders, and children alike have learned a lot over the last 10 years from their ancestors that they can pass on.
I think the biggest reason I'm doing this, or we're doing this, is for our future generation.
Warren says the dig was started for their children so that they will never forget where they came from, and that they are not only excavating, they are finding out and learning about everything. He hopes youth will continue to engage and learn from their work there, with some going on to pursue higher education, to come back as archaeologists and run the project themselves one day. For elders like John Smith, a local carver who's replicated many items dug out of the ground at Nunahlik, the rewards are in keeping with traditional Yupik values through passing down knowledge. Smith says it's important, through generosity and love, to preserve and share the knowledge being gained at Nunahlik, where, among other things, knowledge rediscovered in hunting tools can well mean the survival of the hunter today and those traditions. On the Bering Sea coast in Quinnahock, I'm Christine Trudeau.
A Fairbanks North Star Borough air quality group is mulling over 50 proposals to reduce wintertime pollution from wood, coal, and oil burning. The proposals include banning the use of wood and coal heaters and replacing a coal-fired power plant with a nuclear reactor. Less extreme ideas include building a kiln to dry firewood and beginning local production of ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. Jana Pierce, with stakeholder group facilitator Information Insights, stresses the proposals are being considered from all sides.
We have stakeholders that are wood burners, stakeholders that are wood cutters, stakeholders that are power plant operators or that represent the power plant operators, the military, health industry.
Parts of Fairbanks and North Pole are categorized by the EPA as a serious non-attainment area for fine particulate pollution, and Pierce says that comes with strict requirements.
Anything that any other community in the United States that has gone through this process, anything they've put on the table, we have to adopt it unless we can come up with something better or prove that it's economically or technologically infeasible.
If the area cannot come into compliance, it faces federal sanctions, including loss of transportation funding and costly power plant emissions retrofitting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Strongheart's Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Humpback whales support a whale-watching industry in Juneau worth tens of millions of dollars. The whales migrate to southeast Alaska every year, but for the past few years, many whales haven't come back. KTOO's Jake Steinberg went whale-watching to find out more.
Whale-watching is a popular tourist activity in Juneau. it's easy to see why. No aquarium in the world could hold what this trip offers.
A couple whales kind of hanging out in this area. Not really sure. Oh, wait, there's one right there.
Everyone runs to one side of the boat. They aim their cameras at a dark hump jutting through the waves.
So that whale that just dove had that little white on there. Her name is Sasha.
Each whale's fluke is unique, like a fingerprint. On Sasha's is a mark that resembles the letters A and K. Humpbacks spend the winter down in the warm tropics and return to Southeast Alaska every summer to feast on herring and krill. But over the past few years, some whales haven't been coming back. Chris Gabriel works for the National Park Service in Glacier Bay. She spends the summer sitting in a boat and counting whales. She says the whales were doing great until 2014. Then the number of whales in the park plunged.
It took me aback when so many whales that previously had come to Glacier Bay year after year after year, and we're talking like for 20, 30, even 40 years, all of a sudden disappeared.
Overall, the number of whales in Glacier Bay declined by nearly half between 2013 and 2017. Glacier Bay is the only place in Southeast Alaska where humpback whale numbers are monitored year after year, but anecdotal reports throughout Southeast tell a similar story. Whale numbers are down. Gabriel has a suspect.
People call it the blob.
Yes, the blob. The marine heat wave that swept across the North Pacific beginning in late 2013. It disrupted the entire food chain. The whales returned to this food desert after fasting all winter. And for animals that need as much food as whales do, there just wasn't enough. So does that mean all the whales starved? Well, not exactly.
We're not seeing carcasses. We're not seeing an increased number of dead whales.
That's Susie Tierlink. She's a marine mammal specialist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says it's more likely the whales just went somewhere there's more food. More humpbacks than normal have been reported in the Bering Sea and offshore in the Gulf of Alaska. But there's no way to know for sure where all the whales went. So now that the blob is receding, will the humpbacks that left come back? Tierlink says that depends.
It seems intuitive that there might be a shift back if the prey became available.
Until then, whales like Sasha will have to contend with more boats following them around. With 60 vessels in Juneau and counting, that makes each whale all the more valuable. In Juneau, I'm Jake Steinberg.
The capital city has been one of the most enthusiastic adopters of electric vehicles in the state. There are now more than 200 EVs on the road, but that technology isn't limited to the pavement. One man is on a mission to bring the first fully electric passenger vessel to the water in Juneau. Elizabeth Jenkins from Alaska's Energy Desk hopped on board this unusual boat.
Radio check, channel 16.
There's no internal combustion engine on the Tongass Mist. Instead, it glides along the water quietly, which is tranquil, but weird. You can hear the whine of the electric motors, the whoosh of the water, and that's it.
What do people say to you in the boat harbor when you pull up next to them?
It turns a lot of heads. I mean, no matter where I go, and it'll probably happen today, once we get over to the lightering dock, if there's a vessel in there pitching fish off or whatever, people literally flag you down. Come on over. Is that electric?
And sure enough, before we're even out of the harbor, a woman leans out of the window of her houseboat, delighted. That's awesome, she calls out. So nice. The Tongass Mist wasn't always a gleaming six-person catamaran, the kind of boat I imagine Elon Musk might charter. Barnes describes the dilapidated boat he bought off Craigslist as a shell of corroded junk. At one point, it didn't even float.
I think it's actually been sunk twice.
There seems to be some poetic justice for a boat that sinks to the bottom of the ocean and then is resurrected again and now runs off hydroelectricity.
Yeah, totally born again, yeah.
This remodeled boat can maintain a charge for several hours. And Varna says there's virtually no range anxiety for a number of short excursions. It's powered by 8 lithium batteries, which he charges at the boat harbor when it's docked. Fully electric boats are rare in Alaska or anywhere in the United States, especially ones licensed for commercial passengers. Few boat manufacturers make them, even though the parts are available. And for those skilled enough to take a DIY approach, like Varnas, the U.S. Coast Guard permitting process can be lengthy. Still, Varnas says he started this complicated project out of principle. He first had the idea at one of his old jobs, captaining a whale-watching tour.
You look out at the horizon, and you could see the brown layer of soot looking up towards Haines on the backside of Shelter Island, and thought, wow, that, you know, there's so many boats out here now. Something maybe needs to change.
In retirement, Varnas initiated that change. His first plans included designing a two-story catamaran big enough to carry almost 50 people. He worked with a naval architect for the past 6 years to turn that dream into a reality. The Tongass Mist is his smaller proof of concept. It cost him $50,000 to build. He's poured hundreds of hours of labor into it, meticulously wiring all the electric components himself.
Actually felt pretty hopeless at one point. Thought that this boat's going to sink on paper.
But this summer, he finally completed the Tongass Mist. Now he's working on getting Coast Guard approval for the big battery-powered boat. John Neary, the director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, says he appreciates locals like Varnas helping advance the technology. Soon, they might need it. It's projected the glacier won't be visible from the visitor center in 20 years or so, but tourists will still want to see it. Neary says the U.S. Forest Service is considering electric boats as a way to bring people closer to the retreating glacier.
We're thinking might be easier, cleaner, quieter, to have a slow engine doing just a few knots that would be electric powered, because the technology is there now and will soon be there as people push the technology forward.
Varnas isn't the only entrepreneur in town eyeing the potential of electric boats. Gastineau Guiding, a tour company, is also designing a blueprint for a large electric vessel. But for now, the Tongass Mist is the only fully electric tour boat in Juneau. Back on the water, Varnas says he hopes to have customers on board by next summer.
So it's basically, it's my dream boat. It's everything I ever wanted. And if I don't build another one, that's okay. I got mine.
Varnas recently got the Tongass Mist insured. By default, he received almost $1 million in coverage if the vessel sinks and leaves an oily sheen on the water. He was thrilled to tell the insurance provider that would never happen. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman, Jake Steinberg, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Ravenna Koenig and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Christine Trudeau in Quinhagak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.